Hello again, podcasters, and welcome to this series of podcasts brought to you in association with Kilkenny Library Services and the Government's Decade of Centenaries Fund through Kilkenny County Council. My name is Owen Swinton Welch, and in these podcasts we examine different aspects of Kilkenny's revolutionary era history. Today, however, just like we did previously for 1920, I thought we might rummage through the archives and newspapers from 1921 to try and discover what our parents, our grandparents, or even our great-grandparents would have been talking about in Kilkenny 100 years ago. Now, most of these stories that I will highlight were not directly related in any way to the ongoing War of Independence. It really highlights for us that even in times of turmoil, everyday life does and must go on. In other words, revolutions and republics weren't the only topic of conversation. Now, I thought I'd start on a poignant and more somber note before moving on to some more light-hearted stories. During the first 6 months of 1921, while we nearly always focus on the ongoing conflict between the IRA and the Crown Forces, which was reaching its climax, but there was also a series of four heartbreaking tragedies in Kilkenny City that had little or nothing to do with the political conflict that was ongoing. In other words, in parallel to the War of Independence, clashes like the Friary Seat Ambush and Garry Rickard and Knocknagress and Coolbarn, normal life did go on, with all its ups and downs. All of these four tragedies happened in the first 6 months of 1921 in Kilkenny. For the families involved, the political turmoil of the War of Independence must have been only background noise compared to their own personal devastation. In our first story, a Saturday night in Kilkenny for a few bottles turned to tragedy for one local man. Now, in today's world, we often hear about people getting into a row on an ice house, on rare occasions that can be so-called one-punch attacks. It's sadly not a new thing, however. Something very similar occurred in Kilkenny in 1921. Just after midnight, in the early hours of the 9th of January 1921, 45-year-old Michael Lynch, who was a baker by trade from Upper Walken Street, was returning home, having spent a number of hours in a local pub in the Working Man's Club on Kieran Street. He met a friend, Florence McCarthy, from William Street, and they proceeded towards the direction of home together. They were walking down High Street, but just near City Hall, also known as the Tolsel to the locals, they heard two young men singing loudly. The songs were likely not to be of a patriotic nature to the Irish cause, shall we say. Michael Lynch went to talk to the two young men, crossing from the Monster House side, which is now around Supermax, across to the Tolsel. He likely was telling them to tone it down or perhaps to change their repertoire. An argument broke out, however. Both Lynch and McCarthy were punched by one of the men. Lynch fell back onto the corner of the pavement. He was knocked unconscious, although McCarthy did not believe he was badly hurt at the time. Upon seeing that Lynch was knocked out, McCarthy asked the two men to help him. The accosters felt bad and helped carry Lynch with McCarthy to the fire station office for assistance. The fire station office was then based in City Hall and was part of the council's remit at the time. The fireman on duty did not call for a doctor as he thought the injured man was, quote, suffering only from the drink. Moreover, the three men who carried him were now talking amicably and shared two bottles of stout between them. Lynch was left on a mattress on the ground and all the other men went home. However, Michael Lynch was not all right. He soon took a turn for the worst. He was brought to Kilkenny Workhouse Hospital, located where McDonough Junction Shopping Centre is today, but died there the following day. As mentioned, he was only 45 years of age. The subsequent autopsy discovered that he had fractured his skull upon hitting the pavement, which caused internal hemorrhaging. He was unmarried and his sister Anastasia Bowe was stated to be his only dependent. She commented that he had always been in good state of health and had been liked by everybody. The following are the words of Florence McCarthy, who gave his account of what happened to the subsequent inquiry. I think hearing events in people's own voice really brings history to life, so I've tried to include them throughout the podcasts. So Florence McCarthy stated the following, quote, I met Michael Lynch at Burke's Slip, Kilkenny, about 12:30 p.m. on the night of the 8th of January 1921 and proceeded with him in the direction of the town hall, where I heard two men singing and shouting. Michael Lynch went to talk to them. A discussion followed about the song, but I did not hear the actual words. I expected trouble, so I tried to induce Michael Lynch to come home. Without warning, the younger of the two men struck me in the mouth with his fist and I fell back onto the pavement. When I stood up again, I saw Michael Lynch also on the pavement. I did not see any blow being struck. I thought he, that's Lynch, was stunned and asked the two men to help me to carry him into the fire station. They did so. Lynch remained apparently unconscious the whole time. I said to the younger of the two men who I thought had struck Lynch, "You shouldn't have struck him." He answered, "I am sorry I struck him. I did not send for a doctor because I did not think that Lynch had been badly hurt. The two men seemed to me to be under the influence of drink." End quote. The man who struck the fatal blow on Michael Lynch was coincidentally also called Lynch. That's Thomas Patrick Lynch, though not related. He and his work colleague Joseph Keogh had helped carry Michael Lynch into the fire station. Thomas Patrick Lynch was originally from Dublin and was employed as a canteen assistant for the Devonshire Regiment in Kilkenny Military Barracks. He was soon arrested and charged with manslaughter. A civilian court-martial was held in Kilkenny Military Barracks in lieu of a civilian court trial, which had been suspended because of the introduction of martial law just a week earlier. Although Thomas Patrick Lynch never denied hitting Michael Lynch, the court found there was insufficient evidence to verify exactly which man had actually struck the fatal blow. It's probable that, as death was accidental and remorse was shown immediately, the military court decided leniency was the best option in light of the other serious military matters that were enveloping the country at the time. There was likely a bit of personal camaraderie at play too, and there certainly was a conflict of interest in today's terms, the inquest being held by the military who Thomas Lynch had helped feed every day. A resolution of sympathy for his family was passed out by the local council, while there was also a large attendance at his funeral, of course little consolation to his sister. The second non-political tragedy to hit the city occurred 2 months later. The afternoon of Good Friday, the 25th of March 1921, was a catastrophic day for the Fahy family of Upper Patrick Street, Kilkenny, certainly more of a bad Friday. The family consisted of married couple John and Bridget Fahy and their 5 children aged between 1.5 years and 13 years old. They were Kate, John, Peter, Patrick and their 7-year-old daughter Bridie. At least one other child had passed away after birth some years previously. At around 2 p.m. on that Good Friday, an explosion was heard from inside the Fahy household. A neighbour, Michael Foley, ran across the street and entered the smoke-filled house. He found 38-year-old Bridget Fahy lying in the hallway. He then found her 7-year-old daughter Bridie lying on the floor in the kitchen. His description of events were as follows. Quote, "On the 25th of March, at about 2 o'clock, I was sitting on my own in my house when I heard an explosion in a house on the other side of the street. I rushed across and found Mrs. Fahy lying across the door leading from the kitchen to the hall. I lifted her and carried her towards the street door. There was a lot of smoke about, so I opened the back door. I then went into the kitchen and found Bridie Fahy lying on the floor. I carried her out into the street. In my opinion, the child was already dead. I went again into the house to see if there was any more people there. There were not any more there." End quote. Another neighbour soon came along, Margaret Shields, and she bandaged the large wound on Bridget Fahy's head, but Bridget soon succumbed to her injuries the following day. The husband and father of the deceased, John Fahy, had only stepped outside his home a few minutes earlier in order to get a £1 note changed at Kenny's public house with the aim of getting a present for Bridie, whose birthday was the previous day. As the public house did not have sufficient change, he went to clear his shop from where he heard the explosion. He ran home and called a doctor, but it was all to no avail. It took the RIC some time to arrive. Owing to the troubled times, the RIC would usually only venture outdoors when a large contingent of officers was available. Similarly, it is understandable that many would assume that any type of explosion was related in some way to the ongoing military conflict. When the RIC investigated the house, they found nothing at all to indicate the cause of the explosion. However, all the bricks in the fireplace had been blown out, while the kettle was also shattered into a number of pieces. It later became apparent that the coal dust or some foreign matter in the coal had caused the explosion. So that would be something like a piece of gelignite had found its way into the bag of coal, likely during the mining process. John Fahy stated he had bought the coal locally at Murphy's and that it was imported English coal, which was sometimes cheaper to purchase because of the lower quality. It was discovered that the force of the explosion had caused the metal implements surrounding the fireplace to shatter into pieces, much like shrapnel, and fly around the room. A piece of the kettle had pierced the heart of young Bridie Fahy, killing her almost instantly. Her mother, Bridget, similarly succumbed to bleeding caused by pieces of metal propelled from the explosion. Discovering the cause of the tragedy was of little consolation to John Fahey, who interred his young wife and child together in St. Patrick's Cemetery, Kilkenny, on Easter Sunday, 1921. The next tragedy to hit the city occurred on the 13th of May, 1921. It occurred on Kenny's Well Road and was the scene of another heart-wrenching young fatality. Little Mary Neary, who was 19 months old, decided to leave her grandmother's house and follow her mother, also called Mary, who had gone down the road to fetch a can of water from a nearby fountain. Coming up the street, going in the direction of Ballycallan, was William Kenny, driving his Jarvie cars with two passengers on board. Kenny did not see the child as he was sitting facing the other direction on the cart. Mary Neary ran under the wheels of the cart. Upon hearing her moan, her grandmother, Mary Hackis, ran out of her home and lifted the child from the street. A neighbour, Ellen Blanchfield, tried to help the stricken toddler, but Mary passed away 20 minutes later. She had received fatal spinal injuries. Kenny had continued driving after the accident, as he said he did not see the incident happening. The following is a statement from Mary's grandmother, Mary Hackis. Quote, I am grandmother of the deceased child, Mary Neary. On the 13th of May last, at about 5 o'clock in the evening, I was in my own house with Mrs. Neary, that's her daughter, and the child. I sent Mrs. Neary for a can of water. The child was in the hall at the time. The child left the house without my knowledge. I heard a car passing. I did not see the car at all, and I thought I heard a moan from a child. I rushed towards the back door, thinking it was out in the yard the child went. Not seeing the child there, I rushed to the front door and saw the child lying on its back on the centre of the road. There was blood coming from the child's mouth. I lost control of myself, thinking the child was killed, and I said to a woman, Mrs. Blanche, for God's sake, take the child. The woman took the child across her lap, and when the mother came, she took the child. The child was just dead. There was little moans coming from her. I'm not able to say how the occurrence happened. Later that evening at about 6:30 p.m. I saw the accused, William Kenny, coming with a car from the direction of Ballycallan. When I heard the car coming, I went out and stopped him. I asked him, did he understand what he had done? He said, no. I said, I had the child killed inside. I can't say the exact words he used, but he denied causing the death of the child. I said, of course I knew he did not see the child, owing to his being sitting on the far side of the car. He said his car did not kill the child. I said, no other car passed here. The mother of the child came out and told Kenny he killed her little child. He drove away then. End quote. William Kenny was later arrested. He stated, I did not do it. All I have to say is that I saw no child. In the subsequent trial, the child's parents, Thomas and Mary Neary, bravely said they did not want Kenny to be charged. Instead, they said they wanted nothing from Kenny, but just desired a man to be decent and admit his responsibility for the accident. Kenny was found guilty of manslaughter. The two passengers in the cart, that's Thomas Hickey and John Thornton, were also found guilty as accessories of the crime. The three men had been drinking earlier in the day, so it was seen as a contributing factor. The court believed the three men knew what had happened but drove on as not to get caught. So really heartbreaking stuff there. Now, the final and fourth tragedy occurred on the following month in June 1921. On Monday, the 13th of June, Thomas Mead, aged 56, from Upper Patrick Street in Kilkenny City, died in a fairly rare occurrence for the time. He received fatal injuries in a motor car incident at a period when horses and carts and bicycles were still the most common form of transport. The accident occurred in the middle of the large junction in front of the Bank of Ireland, which is now the Left Bank pub, people will know. Jarvie cars, which were the horse-driven taxis of the time, were nearly always in situ in front of the bank. It was something very much like a taxi rank. Mead was crossing the main junction at the end of the parade and did not see or hear the oncoming Ford motor car proceeding from the direction of the Clubhouse Hotel. The car was driven by Pat MacDonald, who had been hired to drive an Italian tourist and businessman named Luigi Carbella, who was from Milan. Pat MacDonald was employed as a driver with Lewis & Sons of John Street, Kilkenny, who owned the actual car. They would rent it out for the day with a driver, and that's how they made their business. Carbella, the Italian tourist, had travelled to Kilkenny with the intention of purchasing some hunting hounds. The Kilkenny Hunt Club was well known during this era, and hounds were also bred here, and they were well sought after for the purpose of hunting. Now, as the car came down Patrick Street, the engine wasn't running. It was freewheeling, so to speak. This is a habit many used on inclines to save fuel and to not have to make the effort to start the engine as they were going to stop at a nearby shop anyway. Thomas Mead stepped out from behind a number of Jarvie cars situated in front of the Bank of Ireland at the corner of the Parade Patrick Street junctions there, oblivious to the motor coming in his direction. He would have not have heard it as the engine wasn't running. It is also likely that the group of Jarvie cars obscured Mead's view of the road until he stepped out, and it also stopped MacDonald seeing him. MacDonald said that after he saw Mead, he was blowing the horn and others also shouted at Mead, but this seemed to fluster him and he hesitated. The brakes were engaged, but the car struck Mead. He fell backwards and hit the back of his head off the ground. MacDonald gave the following description of events to the inquiry that followed. Quote, at about 10:30 hours, I was driving down Patrick Street to call at Griffin's for some tobacco. I had shut off my engine and was running down the hill. I was sounding my horn all the time as we were approaching the crossroads. There were a number of Jarvie cars near the bank on my right. As I passed round them, I saw Mr. Mead near the centre of the road approaching Croke's Corner. When I saw him first, he was clear of the car, but then some people shouted to him and he appeared to hesitate and jump backwards into my radiator. I had the brakes applied at the time and the car was running very slowly. I pulled up at once and from my position in the driving seat, I could see Mr. Mead's head and chest in front of the radiator of the car. He was lying on his back. End quote. An RIC policeman, Constable Griffiths, who was on duty that day, happened to be coming up Rose Inn Street when the accident occurred. He gave the following account of what he saw. Quote, I saw an elderly man coming across the road in a bleak direction towards me from the Jarvie cars standing by the Bank of Ireland. I myself and others shouted at him as I saw the Ford car approaching him. He didn't seem to take any notice, and when the car was a good yard or so away from him, he seemed to hesitate for a second and step back in front of the car, putting his hands up on the radiator. He then fell back on the back of his head. The car was going slowly at the time. When the driver applied the brakes, the car skidded a couple of yards. End quote. Now the driver of the car, MacDonald, and his passenger, Carbella, placed Mead into the motor car and drove him to the local infirmary hospital. However, Mead unfortunately died there 2 hours later as a result of a fractured skull. He was originally from Galway and a quarryman by trade. He left a widow and a daughter aged 24, a son aged 21, and two stepdaughters. The inquiry held the following day gave an unsympathetic verdict. Now this of course was to lessen any liability or fault in regards to the driver or the owners of the car in any future compensation hearing. One finding was, quote, that Patrick MacDonald, that's the driver, was not to blame for the accident, but Mr. Thomas Mead lost his head when shouted at and made the accident unavoidable, end quote. There was also another recommendation from the court which stated the following, quote, the court wished to add a rider to the effect that the present stand for Jarvie cars, namely in front of the Bank of Ireland, is dangerous for traffic and recommend another be found for them to stand at. End quote. Now to move on to something a little less serious, I thought we'd look at what was in the cinemas, or the picture houses as it was also known back in Kilkenny in 1921. The answer is surprisingly a loss. This was of course the era of silent cinema, sometimes with a live band playing in the venue. It's hard to underestimate just how popular cinema had become in the previous 10 years since it first arrived on these shores. They were big budget epic pictures and an array of slapstick comedies. I have taken a look at the cinema listings for the week beginning Saturday the 1st of January 1921, so this was 1 week before martial law came into effect in Kilkenny. We don't know the ticket sales, but it's safe to say it was likely packed out the door. Also, just remember, this was still in the midst of Christmas season. Unlike today's world, where Christmas seems to end on the 25th of December, 100 years ago, Christmas season started on the 25th of December and went on for 2 weeks until the 6th of January, hence the 12 days of Christmas song. But I am aware that in this century, Christmas starts around October. But back in 1921, people would have took the time off and relaxed during those 2 weeks, especially the farmers. The cinema was a perfect opportunity for the mostly young men and women to meet up, while often being unchaperoned, which of course was an added benefit. There was a surprising amount of film choice for those going to the cinema in Kilkenny on the week of New Year's 1921. One showing could have smaller serials as well as the main film being shown, so it wasn't just the one movie. Quote, showing tonight and tomorrow night, that's Friday and Saturday, and matinee on Saturday at 3 o'clock. A Fight for Love, Thrills of Delight, Thrills of Excitement, Thrills of Love, starring Harry Carey. Under Arrest, episode 14 of The Great Gamble. Her Honour the Scrub Lady, a two-reel screaming farce. Monday and Tuesday, January 3rd and 4th. A Dead Certainty, one of the best racing stories by National Gold. Charlie Chaplin in the Police. Wednesday and Thursday, the 5th and 6th of January, and the matinee on Thursday at 3 o'clock, and of course the 6th was a holy day. Maria Rose, an intense drama of love and vengeance, starring Geraldine Farrar and Wallace Reid. The Friendly Chimpanzees, episode 13 of The Lost Sissy. Friday and Saturday, the 7th and 8th, and a matinee on Saturday at 3 o'clock. The first episode of the great new serial, The Whirlwind, the fastest and most thrilling serial ever made, starring Charles Houston. Also, His Temporary Wife, an uncommon romantic story. End quote. That last one sounds very interesting. One of our nicest looking buildings in Kilkenny is nearly 100 years old this year. Now, I mentioned the Bank of Ireland previously in the podcast, so it's probably only fair that I mention AIB. Plans were submitted in 1921 to partly demolish the Royal Victoria Hotel on High Street and rebuild it as the Munster and Leinster Bank, which was of course the precursor to AIB. That building is still in situ there today beside the Field Pub and looks as it would have done nearly 100 years ago when it was first built. Here's the notice that was printed in May 1921. At the weekly meeting of Kilkenny Corporation on Tuesday night, Mr. Thomas Scully Waterford submitted a plan for the new Munster and Leinster Bank premises about to be constructed on the site of the old Victoria Hotel at the Parade in Kilkenny. The new building will be of a four-storey design with basement. It will be of commodious dimensions and will be fitted up in the most modern style. In external appearance, the building will be of imposing and pretty design. Mrs. Scully explained in a letter that the new front will have a plinth for two lengths of about 10 feet each, extending about 4 inches past the line of the existing hotel wall, and that the steps of the front entrance will not project any further than the existing steps. On the motion of Alderman McGuinness, the plan was unanimously approved of. Alderman McGuinness is a granduncle of the current TD John McGuinness there. Now, us living here in 2021 are unfortunately used to restrictions of one kind or another. Our ancestors in Kilkenny, believe it or not, also had many restrictions in 1921. Events like hurling and theatre were cancelled in the first part of 1921. There were also restrictions on motor transport. Their restrictions, of course, were because of the martial law and not because of public health. Now, we have become used to 5k and 10k restrictions. They had 20 mile radius restrictions and your car could only be driven during the day and not the night. To give a flavour of that, here's a military notice that appeared in the local newspapers. Quote, the use of motor vehicles all over Ireland, except in Dublin and Belfast, will be permitted only between 6 a.m. and 8 p.m. and then only within a radius of 20 miles from the owner's residence. In proved cases of urgency, special permits may be issued by the competent military authority for a single journey only. Doctors, nurses, veterinary surgeons and clergymen may in the meantime use the ordinary permits for professional purposes only. End quote. Now, the said mentioned competent military authority had a harsh and certainly inflammatory way of dealing with things in the village of Mullinavat in South Kilkenny. Although we don't have the full details what had occurred, some locals from the parish were required to sign a declaration saying they were loyal to King George V, which the RIC then had published as a notice in the local newspapers. Now, we don't know what went on beforehand or what threats or punishment would follow if it wasn't signed, but it still was a fairly unusual occurrence, even at this stage of the War of Independence in Kilkenny or Ireland as a whole, for that matter. The notice in February 1921 read as follows, quote, we have been ordered by the authorities to publish the following announcements. Mullinavat, County Kilkenny, the 10th of February 1921. We, the undersigned, do declare that we are loyal subjects of King George V, King of Great Britain and Ireland. Signed, Michael Phelan, Canassi Mun Levas, Michael Hoban Mun Levas, Peter Dwinley, Balnava Mun Levas, James Malone, Red Acres, Near Mun Levas, James Phelan, Canassi Mun Levas, Thomas Duggan, Canassi Mun Levas. Witnesses, J.W. Cawley, Captain, G. Campbell, Constable RIC, G. Neames, Constable RIC. End quote. The Crown Forces also had a novel and modern way of getting their message out in 1921. In May 1921, they dropped hundreds of handbills from an aeroplane. The leaflets fluttered down from the sky all over Kilkenny City. It was all part of the propaganda war that was running in parallel to the military and political battles going on in Ireland at the time. Part of what the leaflets said went as follows, quote, "Two members of IRA, read this, and if you still decide to be led astray by your leaders in the belief that you are soldiers, in inverted commas, and entitled to be treated as soldiers, you have only yourself to blame. Only armed forces who fulfil certain conditions can avail themselves of the rights conferred by the laws and customs of war. These conditions are, 1. They must be commanded by a person responsible for his subordinates. 2. They must wear a fixed distinctive sign or uniform recognisable at a distance. 3. They must carry arms openly. 4. They must conduct their operations in accordance with the laws and customs of war. These laws and customs of war were not drawn up by England for the purpose of fighting the IRA. They were drawn up by all the great nations, including America, in order that the war between men should be carried out in a sportsmanlike manner and not like the fights between savage tribes. Your leaders tell you that you are soldiers belonging to an army. They tell you that you cannot wear uniform and come out into the open and fight because the English are too strong for you, but yet they tell you that if you are captured, you are entitled to be treated as prisoners of war under the laws of war. Your leaders are only lying to you for their own ends. They rarely get captured. They know that a man dressed in civilian clothes who tries to kill another person, whether soldier, police or civilian, is nothing more than a common murderer." End quote. Now, just to change tack slightly, a number of court cases in early 1921 show just how much things have changed for the better. 1921 was certainly an era where women had very little rights. In many ways, they were the property of their fathers first, whose family's respectability was the most important thing, and then they became the property of their husbands. But one of these cases does show that women did have a little clout when it came to marriage proposals. Men today would be shocked to know that it wasn't just marriage that cost them if it ended in divorce, and of course civil divorce was permitted in Ireland at this time, but even breaking a promise of marriage, an engagement as such, could also be quite costly. Quote, "Damages at £450 was assessed by a Waterford City jury to Elizabeth Welch of Killaspie, Slieveroo, County Kilkenny, against John Buckley, a farmer from Tinvacoos, Kilmacow, County Kilkenny, for a breach of promise of marriage." So, for breaching the promise of marriage there, the £450 would be the equivalent of about €26,000 in today's money. Now, in the second case, at the suit of the plaintiff's father for the seduction of his daughter, the jury awarded damages to the father to the amount of £150. End quote. Now, the great philanthropist Ellen, Countess of Trezart, was not happy with the lack of morals being shown at one of her venues at Kilkenny in 1921. Dysart Hall, which we now know as the Ossory Youth Centre on New Street in the city, was leased out to various groups at the time. Word got back, though, to Lady Dysart, who had a fairly conservative Victorian kind of view of the world, it must be said, that there was drinking of alcohol and perhaps other activities, such as up-close and personal dancing, going on in her venue. The Kilkenny Moderator newspaper published the following notice in February 1921. Quote, "It has come to the knowledge of the Countess Dowager of Dysart that the entertainments at Dysart Hall have lately been carried out in a manner much deserving of censure. The rules forbidding the sale of drink have been broken, and in some cases the dancing has been of an unseemly nature. The responsibility for the keeping of the rules and the proper conducting of the dances rests with the lessee who signs the agreement for the night. The hall was built for the pleasure and recreation of the people of Kilkenny, and if this purpose cannot be obtained without detriment to the fair name of the city and county, Lady Dysart wishes to make it quite clear that she will be obliged to most drastically revise the rules which now exist." End quote. The notice was a bit contradictory in that it sounds very much like pleasure and recreation was exactly what the young people were getting by being at that venue. Now, to finish on a more somber note, much like any era of modern Irish history, people, usually women, found themselves unable or not allowed to care for their own children. This could have been because of finances, but the majority of times it was because the mother of the child was not married. It was near impossible for any woman to bring up a child on her own in society if she was unmarried. For this reason, every year in Kilkenny, babies were found by the roadside. Sometimes infants were found deceased, likely because of lack of medical assistance at birth. Some single mothers went to the workhouses to have their babies, with Thomastown being the assigned place for this at the time. It was for this reason that the new Free State government later in the 1920s would sanction the building of mother and baby homes and Magdalen laundries as a way of fixing the problem as it was seen by those governing society. It was no different in 1921, unfortunately. Here's a report from a local newspaper from January 1921. Quote, infant baby found in Kilkenny Church. On Thursday, an infant, a few weeks old, was found in St. Patrick's Church, Ormond Road, College Road, Kilkenny. The discovery was made by some little schoolgirls. The infant was comfortably wrapped up and had a sudra in its mouth. It was taken to a house nearby and subsequently removed to Thomastown Workhouse. End quote. I think that's where we'll leave it there today. Just to thank you once again for all listening. And don't forget to join your local library to avail of all the brilliant free resources. Until next time.